my pleasure this morning to introduce the Reverend Fred Cappuccino. Many of you know him, but some do not. Fred started off as a Methodist minister in Chicago for 10 years. But the Vietnamese War drove him and Bonnie to Canada, where he became minister of the Montreal Point Claire Unitarian Church. He did return to the U.S., though, to help in the great civil rights movement. And like our own minister, Emeritus Felix Lyon, he marched at Selma in 1965. When Fred and Bonnie married in 1953, they decided they would have no more than two biological children. But after the first two sons, they adopted 19 more children of many different races and born in different countries. Then finally, Fred suggested they might be too old to adopt any more children. But Bonnie said, "I have an idea." The idea? In 1976, that idea became the first of 10 children's homes in South Asia, with the 1,200 children and widowed women and orphan seniors being looked after. That was Bonnie's idea. 11 church members and 3 children from First, Faith Children, and several visitors here today have visited or volunteered one or more of the children's homes located in India, Nepal, Tibet, and Bangladesh. And I wondered if they might stand. Anybody here who's visited? So you can see there's quite a few people here who visited, and some of our youth plan to visit in the future. Thank you. Personally, I found a 3-month term was so rewarding that I volunteered a second time. It's a great experience. Both Bonnie and Fred have received so many rewards that I lose count. Key to me are the Order of Canada and the UNESCO Award for their humanitarian work. Child Haven is also one of the Globe and Mail's 5 best-run charities in Canada, because little money is spent in Canada and most of the money goes overseas. They remain very active directors of Child Haven, despite their age, with Bonnie continuing to visit the homes 4 times a year, and Fred is in charge of the Canadian arm, as well as being Minister Emeritus of the Ottawa Unitarian Fellowship. Again, we welcome Fred to our church.
Thank you, Christine. I don't know if I told the story here before. Likely I have, but maybe there are 2 or 3 who haven't had it, about the minister who was saying salvation is free as water. Did I tell that story? The minister was, this is in regard to the pledge campaign. The minister was saying salvation is free as water. And he kept saying that over and over. And one wise guy in the congregation said, "Well, Pastor, how come you keep telling us salvation is free as water? And then you have this pledge campaign and we're really pressed to sign on the dotted line." And the minister said, "Salvation is free as water. It's the plumbing that costs so much." Machiavelli, in 1500 A.D., wrote of the hardship in trying to change the status quo. "There is nothing more difficult," said Machiavelli, "to take in hand, more perilous to conduct, or more uncertain in its success, than to take the lead in the introduction of a new order of things. Because the innovator has for enemies all those who have done well under the old conditions and lukewarm defenders in those who may do well under the new. 50 years ago, Don Johnston was minister of the Unitarian Church in Niagara Falls. Now deceased, he was well loved by his congregations. I knew a couple who traveled 500 miles for counseling with him, and he told the story of his first funeral. While in theological school, said Don, I was asked if I wanted to be the minister of a particular church. I wondered whether the salary would be suitable and was told $70 a month. That was a long time ago. I was dusting out one of the rooms at the church, making a study for myself, putting a few books in, when a man came to the door. "Well, they're getting younger every day. Have you ever done a funeral service?" I said, "No." "Do you have a book of services?" I said, "No." "Have you ever seen a funeral service?" I said, "No." This fellow was the local undertaker. He took me up to a congregational minister 16 miles away. That minister entrusted me with a leather-bound book his congregation had presented to him with his name emblazoned in gold letters. At the grave, the undertaker told me where to stand near the casket as it sat over the open grave. At the conclusion of the service, as he pushed the button for the casket to lower, the ground gave way under me, and I slid right down into the grave while the casket was slowly descending. He turned off the button, raised up the casket, and helped me out. I was all muddy and was brushing myself off. As the casket was lowering again, I remembered I had left the book down there. And so he threw his hands up in the air, stopped the casket, and told the people he would lower it after the group had left. So that was my first funeral. Don Johnson went home full of despair with a heavy heart and a muddy suit. The amazing Jane Goodall worked with chimpanzees in Africa. A reporter recently asked her, "What is your earliest memory?" Jane Goodall said, "An early memory is watching a hen laying an egg. I went into an empty hen house and waited for a hen to come in. I waited for 4 hours at age 4. It showed what an amazing mother I had. No one knew where I was, but when everyone else was searching and worried, mother saw this excited little girl running toward the house. She didn't say, 'How dare you go off without telling us?' That would have killed my excitement. She saw my shining eyes and she sat down to listen while I explained to her how a hen lays an egg." All of you could tell a story about a child in your life. An incredibly beautiful child. I'd like you to ponder this question. Is there anything in this world as beautiful or as precious as a child? On Remembrance Day, we honor those who gave their life for their country. The dedication and sacrificial spirit of these people is certainly to be respected and honored. But We do not have to honor war itself. After the Vietnam War, one soldier told of being ordered to take part in destroying a village so as to have something to blame on the Viet Cong. The image of killing children will haunt his sleep for the rest of his life. Some 45,000 American young men died in the war, but a larger number of veterans who came home later on committed suicide. That is an astounding statistic. You just can't forget killing a child. Years of psychotherapy will not get rid of it. According to the second law of thermodynamics, if I am not mistaken, whenever there is change in the natural physical world, there is also entropy. You scientists will correct me in all this. We can always count on there being scientists in a Unitarian congregation, each of which is equipped with a ratio of 28.6% scientists in its membership. Entropy is a measure of disorder. In other words, whenever change takes place, there are unforeseen repercussions. So if change is coming, the goal is to have it take place in such a way that there is the least amount of entropy. Someone asked a Canadian high school class what they knew about Mahatma Gandhi. The sum total of what they knew was that he was bald, he was dead, he lived in India. Most people, even in India, have forgotten their greatest teacher. He taught the equality of the sexes, but today the treatment of women is appalling. The female infanticide, the wife beating, the rape murder, all of these have been largely ignored by the police in India. Child Haven was organized in the basement of Lakeshore Unitarian Congregation near Montreal as what's your name? As Christine said, I'm 87. Not Christine, me. As Christine said, Child Haven was organized in 85. Has 9 children's home and 1 women's home in India, Nepal, Bangladesh, and Tibet. Bonnie spends half the year making 4 trips to administer all of the homes as well as some projects, some women's projects. We try very imperfectly to follow Gandhian teachings. Gender equality, simple living, no proselytizing, no recognition of caste, vegetarianism, nonviolence. At our Nepal home, a visiting Canadian woman wanted to find out whether boys had preferential treatment. So she asked the 13-year-old girl about this. The woman didn't want to seem too nosy, so her questions were rather oblique. At first, the girl didn't understand, but when it dawned on her what the woman was trying to get at, the girl said proudly, "At Child Haven, we have gender equality." The teaching of Gandhi that has profound relevance for today is nonviolence. Reconciliation of groups of people who have conflicting interests. During Gandhi's Satyagraha campaigns in South Africa and India, the white oppressors had a massive change of mind and heart, and the change was accomplished with a minimum of entropy. And Christine also referred to Selma, Alabama. That was a 100% pure Gandhian struggle, and that's where I met Felix. And I've known him since then. That was 1965. Many Westerners Indeed, many people of India tend to underestimate the power of nonviolence. Many take it as an obvious fact that one should fight back. Gandhi would have agreed with that. It's a matter of how you fight back. One story from the Satyagraha movement in India. Satya means truth, graha means holding firmly. And this was written by a Chicago Daily News reporter in Bombay, 1930. So I'm quoting this reporter. 6 a.m. at the police station facing the park, some hundreds of yellow-turbaned, bare-legged Marathi policemen were leaning on their dreaded lathis under the command of a score of English police sergeants. At 6:45, marching down the boulevard, came the ambulance unit with Red Cross badges on their arms. They marched past the police, parked their ambulances, and brought out their stretchers. At 7 o'clock began the processions of white-robed volunteers bearing banners, singing, "We will take Swaraj," which means independence. "India, our motherland." At the head of each walked a tiny detachment of women and girls dressed in orange robes, many garlanded with jasmine. They marched past the policemen and lined up behind the stretcher. Marathi policemen marched toward the standing Satyagrahis. They went faster and faster. The Hindus watched them approach. Then the police broke into a charge. Some Hindus ran, but most stood still. Crash, whack, whack. Only the orange-clad women were left standing beside the prostrate figures of crumpled men. Congress volunteer ambulances were clanging bells. Stretcher bearers were running helter-skelter across the field. Whack, whack. A minute's lull, and then with flags flying, another column of volunteers marched onto the field. A clash, dull thuds. Then the faint-hearted ran, and again the field was dotted with a line of fallen bodies, and again orange-clad women holding up flags of Swaraj. And here in the center of one of these islands sat a little knot of men, their heads bowed, submitting to a rain of lathi blows, refusing to move until on a stretcher and completely laid out. There were stretchers within 2 feet of the suffering men waiting for them. Then came a band of 50 Sikhs and a heroic scene. With them were 15 young girls and women smiling as if they liked danger. These Sikhs swore they would not draw their kirpan swords to defend themselves, and they would not leave the field. They did not. "Never, never," they cried, "we will never retreat, we will die." The police hesitated before hitting the Sikhs, not out of fear but respect. They asked their women, "Would they please, please leave the field?" "No," said the women, "we will die with our men." Mounted Indian policemen galloping across the field, whacking heads indiscriminately, were stymied when they faced the little cluster of blue turbans on the Sikh men. "The Sikhs are brave men. How can we hit them?" But the police, determined to clear the field, at last rushed around the Sikh women and began to hit the men. The reporter stood within 5 feet of a Sikh leader as he took the lathi blows. The blows came. He stood straight. His turban was knocked off. The long black hair was bared with a round top knot. He closed his eyes as the blows fell until at last he swayed and fell to the ground. No other Sikhs tried to shield him, but now they wiped away the blood streaming from his mouth. Hysterical Hindus rushed to him bearing ice to rub the contusion over his eyes. The Sikh gave me a smile and stood for more. And then the police threw up their hands. "You can't go on hitting a blighter when he stands up to you like that." India, by nonviolent action, achieved independence from the powerful British Empire. Not only that, but the two countries had immediate friendly relations. Most countries, after a conflict of such duration, have decades of bitterness. There was friendship after this war. Came with a minimum of entropy. I want to tell two stories about the Gandhian aspect of Child Haven. The first story takes place back in 1997. Three siblings were living at our Child Haven home in Hyderabad. Two boys, aged 7 and 9, and their sister Sunita, 13. They were from an underprivileged tribal community. After some time, their father brought his youngest daughter, age 5, to Child Haven to be with her three older siblings. At the same time, his friend brought his own two children to be admitted, boys age 7 and 10. Their mother had run away. When the first father returned home, he took his daughter Sunita, the 13-year-old, to help him with some chores at home, was the alleged purpose. But Sunita's friends said that she had confided to them that her father was planning to marry her off, and she didn't want to marry. She's a brilliant student. And when Bonnie heard about this, Bonnie pondered what to do. Appealing to the father probably would not influence him. But Bonnie couldn't ponder too long. She decided to up the ante. She immediately sent the other three siblings home to their father, and his friend's two children were sent back to their father as well. The ploy succeeded. All six children were returned to Child Haven, and the father signed an agreement that all four of his children would complete their education at least through 10th grade. That's where they graduate in India. Sunita graduated from high school. Because of financial restraints, most of our Child Haven students go to a trade school, vocational school. But if a child is really brilliant and really keen to study, we find sponsors in Canada who will pay the $2,000 a year for university. Sunita completed her university training, went on to finish her master's degree. She is happily married to a fine young man of her choice. The other story took place at our Kaliampundi home near Madras, which is now called Chennai. A few years ago, a 9-year-old boy, one of our boys, fell into a well and drowned. We were all devastated. He had attended the local government school, as did most of our Kaliampundi children. Apparently, 3 or 4 boys had a call of nature at school, but the toilets at the school were filthy and all clogged up, so they went out into the bush. On the way back, the one boy said he wanted to wash his hands in the well. It's an unused, huge, round affair with sloping sides. He slipped, fell down into the water, and drowned. When Bonnie heard the story, she went up to the school and talked to the principal and staff. They didn't want to take responsibility for the dirty toilets, which were full of various kinds of debris, including plastic, broken bottles, as well as feces. Bonnie went back to our children's home. She told our manager and some others that she was going back up to the school to clean the toilets as a part of her Gandhian discipline. Our manager and nurse wanted to participate as well as some of the older children. They took rakes, brooms, buckets, and disinfectants to the school. The staff there were appalled. They said to Bonnie, "No, don't do that. Here, sit down." I brought a chair. But Bonnie and the others began raking the debris out and then cleaned the toilets with disinfectant. The school staff stood there horrified because cleaning toilets was the work of the untouchables or Dalits. Mahatma Gandhi was absolutely against the caste system, but he cleaned toilets himself, and he cleaned toilets himself. He was totally incorruptible, would not accept any presents from anyone except for a special kind of toilet which someone gave him. He accepted that for symbolic reasons. So this was a Gandhian lesson to our children and staff, and indeed the whole community who talked about it for many months. Is there anything, anything in this world as beautiful or as precious as a child? Let us remind people, there is a precious, incredibly beautiful child in your life. When you are considering building a palace for yourself, or a cruise, or a Mercedes, or a casino, there is a child in your life who needs you desperately, to the exclusion of everything else. Devote your life to this child. In closing, one more story about a child, 6 years old. Her father was a doctor. A man called on the phone and asked for her father. She said, he's at the hospital performing an appendectomy. That's a big word for a little girl. Do you know what it means? She said, it means $800, and that doesn't include the anesthesiologist. Twenty-five centuries ago, the prophet Isaiah said, the wolf shall dwell with the lamb, and the leopard shall lie down with the baby goat, and the calf, and the lion, and the fatling together, and a little child shall lead them.